Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about this big story. You may have seen it in the news. Google has announced that they have created a quantum chip that can perform insane calculations using a benchmark. They were able to create a chip that can perform in just 5 minutes what a supercomputer would take 10 septillion years to do. And no, the universe is not that old. We're going to be talking about what exactly quantum chips are and what we might be using them for in a bit. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Migrating very shortly to Blue Sky, by the way, if you're on Blue Sky. We get to all those comments at the end of the programme. First, though, as always, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Susan Kelleher from School of Chemical Sciences in DCU and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Feeling Christmassy yet?
Yes.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, I'm loving it now. I've gotten a lot of the work over with and I'm looking forward. I'm feeling good.
What are you looking forward to?
We've got a Christmas football match with the kids. We've got a Christmas basketball match. We go to the zoo on Christmas Eve every year.
Nice.
We have a lot of weird traditions. But actually, Christmas Eve, a zoo, is a lovely time to go. Lovely. Nice.
Not anymore.
Walk.
You just told everyone.
No, I'll see you all there. It'd be great. Just leave me a parking space. All right. Let's go into the news. Our first story has to do with lorries. That, by the way, is a clip from Convoy, which is a movie from, 1978 about these truckers that were in a convoy. All I know is the 10-4 rubber ducky. It was a big deal in the 1980s.
You have missed a big opportunity here. Uh-oh. Would you not have gone for the holidays are coming jingle? Maybe it's too commercial.
No, no. I know what you're doing, though. You're mixing. This is to do with a lorry that contains something a lot more dangerous than coke.
Yes, absolutely. Antimatter. This is from CERN, and it's sort of angels and demons come to real life.
No one has read that book.
Yeah. No one has ever read that book. I've just seen the film. I wouldn't read those books, for God's sake. But basically, CERN is able to make antimatter, which is the opposite to matter. When the universe was created, the likelihood of there being as much antimatter as matter was real, right? So we shouldn't have matter in the universe, but yet we do. So we're made of matter, all the protons and neutrons and electrons, etc. Stuff, as Susan would call it as a chemist. But the reason that we have matter and not antimatter in the universe is a mystery. So we need to make antimatter if we want to understand its properties and see if there are slight differences to matter, or are they perfect mirrors of one another.
So this is one of those bits of physics that absolutely blows my mind. What the hell is antimatter?
So if you imagine that most atoms, or all atoms, sorry, Susan, are made up of protons, right? They're the kind of the most fundamental unit of atoms, and different number of protons, different elements. And there are other bits in there too. But you can have, for every one of those particles, you can have the antiparticle of it. So it basically does the exact opposite. It's like the evil twin, right? So CERN is able to do this by taking kind of high speed beams of protons and slamming them into a metal, right? And de-accelerate them very, very quickly. And as a result of that, they're able to make a lot of very sort of fancy particles, including antimatter. And they can isolate individual antiprotons and positrons, also known as anti-electrons. They can even make anti-atoms. So they can add the constituent particles together and make it the opposite or the inverse of simple things atoms.
What happens if an antimatter met a bit of matter?
That's the exciting part. They annihilate one another, right? With a bit of a bang.
Right.
Which is one of those things that Star Trek also got right when it comes to science. But fortunately, they're not able to make enough antimatter for us to have a matter-antimatter explosion of note. We're talking tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of stuff here. Really small. Yeah. So it is said to be the most expensive material that you could make. It's volatile and expensive. Kind of reminds me of you, Jonathan, in a way. Right? And when you make antimatter, in order for you to keep it away from regular matter, you have to put it into a field, right? You have to hold it in a field, an electric or a magnetic field.
But like a field in Mayo.
Zing. So what's interesting here is that they've been able to build a container for antimatter, and now they're shipping it across Europe, right? And hopefully they're using better shipping companies than most of us are using to get our Christmas presents, right? It's a CERN-sponsored project. And what I was really curious about was, why don't they just do the experiments they want to do in CERN rather than have to build a complicated way of getting the antimatter out to the labs? The reason is that there's a lot of strong magnetic fields in CERN, and so you can't do sensitive experiments there. You have to send it away to a reasonably quiet place. When I was explaining this to my wife earlier, she said, "Do you mean like somewhere where there's no people or out in a field, like just like your comet?" It's like, no, I think not. I'd probably somewhere that's very electromagnetically quiet. So we're able to do very sensitive experiments to see, is the positron the exact inverse of the electron? Is the antiproton the exact inverse of the proton? And if there are
but like
asymmetries,
the thing, like the machine that the particle accelerator that's under CERN,
yeah,
and the ATLAS detector, though, that's an enormous thing. What exactly are they? What is on the truck? They're not accelerating these. They're taking these antimatter particles that they've created and then bringing them somewhere else.
Yeah.
But they've already made it.
Made them, and they have to keep them as antimatter, keep them separated from matter until they get to wherever they need to go, so that other physicists and chemists can do playful experiments.
Do we know where they're going?
To top secret locations across Europe.
Really?
No, I don't know. If there are Irish scientists listening that are working on it, I'd love to know more about that. Why are they doing antimatter? Does Ireland have policy and science on antimatter?
I would say as well, this sounds like a Christmas special with the rock that's going to go wrong where that truck crashes.
Oh, yeah.
You're watching very different Christmas movies from me, I've got to be honest with you, Susan. All right, our second story is an interesting one. It's kind of a topical one, right? It's about human embryo research. And for obvious ethical reasons and also cultural reasons, we limit the amount of time that we allow basic research to be performed on embryos.
That's right.
There are people who want that to change.
There are. And this is a report that was in The Guardian this week. And just as you said, the time frame at the moment to study embryos once they are created is 14 days. The reason 14 days is chosen is it's because it's the time in the development of an embryo when what's called the primitive streak is developed, which is a precursor to the brain and the spinal cord. So it's sort of decided that that would be the cutoff point for that reason, because you're getting sort of more and more towards what life is.
But it's kind of arbitrary.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It was just decided upon by sort of the people who work in this field that we need to have a standard that everyone abides by.
Yeah.
And the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority in the UK have now recommended this week that the laws in the UK are changed to allow that to extend to 28 days. And the argument here is that the time in the embryonic development up to 14 days, there's a lot to learn in that time, but there's an awful lot to learn after that time.
Yeah.
In this case, they're going to argue that it's the 14 to 28 days time frame that they basically call it this black box of embryonic development. And there's loads of things that happen within those days. For example, between days 14 to 42, this is when sort of errors in placenta formation happen, growth restrictions within cells occur. And then between 21 and 35 days development, this is when heart defects can be noticed, skeletal abnormalities, they think, and certain types of cancer even can start to be detected between 21 to 35 days in embryonic development. But there are very limited capacities to study this. Now, in the UK, it's 14 days, but a lot of, in 2021, the International Society for Stem Cell Research, which is basically the big organization of all the people who work in this area, they ceased to endorse the 14-day cutoff.
Yeah.
They've kind of said, leave it to the academics and leave it to sort of national organizations to decide if there are specific things that researchers want to look at after that time frame, and that is decided nearly on an individual basis. Because of some of these things that are happening at that still very early stage, especially around infertility and you know, miscarriages, these things happen really early in so much of the time, you know?
It's a philosophical question more than anything, though, right? Because, I mean, it's like, when does life begin? That age-old debate that causes us so many problems, causing problems in the States States right now, you know, what, you know, obviously, if you can feel pain, if you, you know, if you can have conscious thought, these are obvious ones, but wouldn't you go a little bit beyond that?
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
So the argument here as well is the stem cell-based human embryos, they're models, right? They're not equivalent to human embryos that are produced in fertilization with the egg and the sperm. So they don't possess all the exact same characteristics and potential that the embryos produced by fertilization have. So this is why there's sort of a little bit of room here around understanding as a model what can happen in the, you know, fertilized models or fertilized embryos rather than these models. And ethically, of course, there's continuous issues, but I suppose they also speak about the fact that 186 million people a year are affected by infertility. So we need to do something to understand what's happening in those early stages.
Yep. Our third story, Shane, has to do with the expanding universe. And this is also quite an interesting one.
Yeah, speaking of models, the standard model, right? The one that physicists love because it explains the evolution of galaxies, something like the abundance of the various elements we have. But there's so many gaps in it. I always explain to students that physics is not the universe. Physics is the map of the universe. And every so often we need new maps, and every so often we can create new detail in our existing maps. That's where the so-called new physics comes in. And so these edges in which we're tinkering are the exciting parts. And this is a classic conundrum. We know, as Monty Python sang, the universe itself keeps expanding and expanding in all of the directions we can whiz, right? But what we didn't know until recently is that the rate of expansion has changed. So the expansion of the universe is accelerating, and we don't know why. And so we had observations from the Hubble telescope that gave us this data, but it was only one source of data. And so now the James Webb telescope, or JWST as people call it, is a second source of data. And that's what this story is about. They have used the JWST to verify what the Hubble telescope found, which is that the universe is expanding at a rate way beyond what the standard model predicts. And so we're trying to figure that out now.
This is, which is really cool, because with this new telescope, we knew we would learn new things, and we saw so many exciting new things in the sky. But these observations are leading us to go back to the drawing board and try and figure out, okay, wow, so this is not what, you know, because you have all your theoretical physics and the standard model. A lot of it is, you know, theoretical, right? We haven't been able to observe a lot of what's in there.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing in the night sky things that are getting us to kind of question what we thought we knew.
Yeah, well, when you read the figures that are involved, it's incredible, like that the universe is expanding at 70 odd kilometers per second per megaparsec. And a megaparsec is 9.4 trillion kilometers wide. So when you think about the fact that, you know, even in the fabric of the space that you and I occupy is itself fundamentally stretching and changing. And I just think that's remarkable. And I was thinking about it on the bus in, and I was like, does that mean with time that, say, you and I are getting slowly and slowly further apart? No is the answer, because, of course, the unit with which we measure distance is itself changing as the universe expands. So our idea of the meter is relative to the universe in which we exist. So I think these sorts of, if you were wanting to go deep over Christmas with your family members and avoid the unnecessary rubbish about elections and whatnot, talk about this kind of stuff. Talk about the fabric of the universe and where we all come from.
Our final story, Susan, has to do with exercise. And if we're looking forward to our Christmas dinner, usually there's a walk involved in between while the mum or dad or whoever's cooking wants everyone out of the house, please. But exercise is good for us.
That's it. That's the take-home point. If you're switching off now, exercise is good for you.
End of story.
End of story. This story comes from the University College London, and it looked at the effect of 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity and sleeping for at least 6 hours at night, the effect that had on the memory of people the next day. So moderate to vigorous is basically brisk walk, running. You can talk, but not sing or hold any long conversations. And they studied this by asking 76 adults between the ages of 50 and 83 who had no cognitive impairment to wear an accelerometer for 8 days, which tracked their sleep and activity during their normal life. And then each day, participants were given a simple test to check their memory. And the results showed that each 30-minute increase in moderate to vigorous exercise the day before, once you had slept well, corresponded to a 2 to 5% increase in working memory the next day. And previous studies have shown sort of similar things, but they've all been done in labs and under very controlled conditions, whereas this was done in real life. So even though it was a small cohort of people, it was a good idea. What they really want to do, though, is, I suppose, I don't know how beneficial that might be to any of us here, but for people who have cognitive impairment, an additional boost to their working memory the next day, if you do, you know, some small, moderate exercise the day before, that's what they want to focus on next. And that's their next goal in this research project, is to try and, you know, see how much of a benefit this can be for people who already maybe are having a difficult time at memory loss in their everyday life. So I really liked the study. It was small, but, you know, I thought it was quite well done, and just a sort of very simple intervention that could have a big effect. And yes, so there you go.
More proof that exercise is good for you, as if you didn't
you
already
heard it
know.
Here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tell everybody. extra. Read all about it. Dr. Susan Kelleher from DC, from UCD. Shane Bergen, thank you so much. Now, earlier this week, Google unveiled a new computer chip that they say can, in 5 minutes, solve a problem that would take your average supercomputer 10 septillion years to complete. And just to clarify, 10 septillion years is billions of times longer than the universe has been around. Now, it annoys me how slow my Instagram photos load up when I scroll down my profile page, but I'm not entirely sure we need a computer of this ability to do that. But if it's not for that, what are they for? Dr. Kieran Hickey is assistant professor in the School of Physics at UCD and a member of UCD's Centre for Quantum Engineering Science and Technology, CQEST. He joins me now. Kieran, you know, I was saying this earlier in the programme, like, I always thought that the quantum computing thing was something that was so far, kind of like fusion, you know, this thing is so far away in the future. And I was reading stories about, oh, we've done this and we've done that, but I didn't think we were really practically getting to a stage where we're using quantum computers. This is quite a big announcement, even though there have been other announcements before. Tell me first exactly what a quantum computer is, and you might tell me a little bit about the quantum mechanics underneath it if you can.
Yeah, of course. I think to explain what a quantum computer is, it's perhaps first best to go back and think about what a conventional ordinary computer is, like you might have your desktop at home or, for example, in your pocket. So a conventional computer, I mean, nowadays they're modern marvels of engineering, but if we abstract all of that away for a second and just think about the core of really what a computer does. So a computer is based around bits. So you're probably familiar with gigabytes, terabytes, if you're, say, buying a hard drive. A byte is 8 bits, and a single bit is just something like 0 or 1. On, off, for example, red, blue, it has 2 states accessible to it. And so then in a computer, you have an array of bits. So let's say you want to add 2 numbers together, 5 and 6. You would, as your input into the bits, you would put the numbers 5 and 6. Then you would do some operations on those bits. People would refer to them as logical gates, things like AND gates, OR gates, these kinds of things. So they might do things like, you know, flip a bit from a 0 to a 1. They might check if 1 bit is 0 or 1. Then depending on that value, flip the neighboring bit to 0 or 1, things like that. And through doing all of these different gates on your initial input, you then get to some output configuration of zeros and ones.
And so your answer essentially is just a list of zeros and ones.
Precisely,
that,
yes.
Which is what everyone knows as binary. So
exactly.
These computers, and the reason that they're binary is because these used to be physical switches of on and off, right? And they also, they correlate to electrical switches, and that's how that's how electricity and all of the things in our computers work, on these zeros and ones.
Precisely, yes. So in an abstract sense, they're these zeros and ones. But like you said, physically, you actually have to build something a bit. and physically, you know, like I said, they can often be represented as on and off, say an electrical current being on or off.
Yeah.
There's the physical hardware, the actual implementation of the bit, and then there's the more abstract meaning of it, which is this mathematical concept or physical concept of a bit.
Yeah.
And then that output, you know, your computer would then translate that output of bits, those zeros and ones, back into, say, a number. So if you're adding 5 and 6 together, if the computer's done it correctly, the final configuration of bits, zeros and ones, would correspond to the number 11. So then you've done your calculation correctly.
Yeah, that's, and people might remember from maths, you know, if you want to make any number in the universe, you can do that by using zeros and ones. So
exactly.
0 is 0, 1 is 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. And then if you want to have 2, it's 1, 1. And so on and so forth, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so you can make any number in the world just using zeros and ones, which is why it's such a simple and beautiful system, and mathematicians love it.
Right.
So these computers have these chips that can very, very, very quickly, on a really tiny, tiny scale, turn on and off, and then mix these two binary things together, put them through, as you say, yes or no sort of matrices,
precisely,
and end up with a computer.
Exactly.
And we've explained computers in, what was it, 3 minutes?
Exactly, and modern computers have billions upon billions upon billions of these bits. And to do something like render, say, a computer game, They're doing millions upon billions upon billions of these gates, these switches.
Which is incredible when you think about it, the amount of things that's happening. But it's all at the very core of it, zeros and ones.
Precisely. That's the very simple core. But of course, nowadays, to have a running smartphone, you need, you know, an enormous amount of power, and you get this huge complexity then emerging out of that.
Right. So quantum computing makes the zero and one a lot more complex.
Indeed. A lot more complex, but also more powerful. And that's the key. So in the quantum computer, again, if we abstract away the very complicated engineering for a second and we just focus on the, you know, how it works in an abstract sense, the bits are replaced by quanta bits, which people shorten to qubits. So if you read articles about it, you'll often see this term qubits. So it's the quantum version of a bit. So that's a quantum mechanical system that has two quantum states available to it, which in analogy, people usually refer to as zero and one, just as the way that we use zero and one for the conventional computer. But this quantum bit is quite different in the sense that not only can the quantum bit be in a state one or in a state zero, but it can also be in what we call a superposition. So in some sense, that's neither in one nor zero, but something in between. So for example, you might have a quantum bit that's in the superposition of zero and one, such that when you measure the quantum bit, you might measure zero. Now you repeat it again, and you measure again, and this time you get one. And you keep doing that, you keep repeating and measuring. Each time it seems random, you seem to either get zero or one. But if you look back at the history of what you recorded, you'll see 50% of the time you got zero, and 50% of the time you got one.
Mm-hmm.
So then in some sense, even though each individual measurement seemed random, when you look back, you could say that your qubit was in a superposition of, you know, zero and one, or kind of 50-50 of zero and one. And it doesn't have to be 50-50. One way people often like to imagine qubits, the state of a qubit, is if you think of the surface of a sphere, like the surface of the Earth, you could represent the one state as the North Pole,
yeah,
and the zero state as the South Pole. And now you can think of this 50-50 configuration as a point that's lying on the equator. So, you know, half the time you'll measure one, half the time you'll measure zero. But of course, you don't have to sit on the equator. You could sit, for example, where Ireland's located, between the North Pole and the equator.
53 degrees north, yeah.
Precisely. And so in that case, if you measured it, again, each time it would seem random, you'd get maybe one or zero. But if you look back again at the history, you'd get maybe something like, you know, 70% ones, 30% zeros. Or something.
Right,
like
okay. And so the superposition is almost like in a sort of a blend of zeros and ones in a way.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
So previously, we only were able to use computers that have zero and ones. That limited their processing capability because there's only so much you can do with zeros and ones. You can do lots of things very fast, but it's still quite limiting. But when you add zeros, ones, and then blends of those up from anything between zero and one, any sort of
any
mix.
Any blend, yeah.
Then you have almost an infinitely larger ability to create these outputs, which you can then mix to each other and make more outputs. And that is quantum computing?
Yeah, so in a sense, the magic comes, you know, just like when we think about conventional computers, the single bit is maybe not so interesting. But what's interesting, of course, is we have many bits. Then we can start doing these gates on them, these AND/OR gates you mentioned earlier, to get an output answer. So here we'd start with these quantum bits, which, like you said, are much more difficult and more powerful than the usual bits. But of course, if we want a final answer, we need many of these quantum bits, and we encode our input. You know, let's say if we're adding two numbers, we encode those two numbers into the initial bits. Then we want to do gates. But now we have to do quantum gates. So just like we had quantum bits, we also have quantum gates.
Right. And so I think we've got the gist of it. We can go a little bit deeper, but I want to get an idea of how you build something like this now. So using silicon or the traditional chip architecture that we see on our Intel chip inside our computers, uses a particular type of solid state material. Quantum computers use a different way of measuring these states and a different way of building them using different materials.
Correct. So you want to encode somehow this quantum bit into a physical, you know, system. So you want some sort of physical implementation of this quantum mechanical two-level system. And so it's a little bit more complicated than classical computing because there's actually many different possibilities pursued by different companies. So for example, the Google result that you mentioned earlier, they have a particular computing architecture. So they've based their particular quantum bits on what are called superconducting qubits. So in some sense, the one and zero, these quantum states, are encoded in kind of clockwise and anti-clockwise circulations of very small nanoscale currents.
Okay, so when you say small nanoscale currents, you're talking about it's not subatomic particle reading, is it? Or because that's what when we think of, you know, quantum mechanics, we're talking about, you know, particles that are smaller than atoms. And protons and smaller neutrons. Is that what we're talking about when we're talking about these?
So slightly larger scale, actually.
Okay.
So the nanoscale, so not certainly something that you could see with your eye, but not at the level of a single atom, at least in Google's case. Now, like I said, there are other architectures out there. So there are other ways of encoding these qubits. So there's another company based in the United States, IonQ, and there they actually encode these qubits into actually single ions, so single atoms. So in that case, the qubit really is encoded on a single atom,
which is incredible. I mean, it delivers an immeasurable amount of extra computing power, because of course it's not just exponential; it's not just the power of 2 or the power of 10. We're talking about billions of times the power, and like 24 order of magnitude, right? So can you just put that into context? Because when you read that this machine can do this, it's kind of crazy. How do they get this number that this this new quantum computer can do in 5 minutes what another supercomputer would take 10 septillion years to do?
Right. So what they do is they basically do the calculation first on a smaller number of qubits. So something that doesn't take 10 septillion years to do, but a very small number, which they can then check with a conventional computer. Then they scale up a little bit bigger. They see how much time that takes. They scale up a little bit bigger, see how much time that takes. And then, you know, if they keep scaling up, they eventually get to a point at which they can no longer check it with their conventional computer.
Right, of course, because you've run out of time.
Exactly. Right. But they can, you know, estimate based on, you know, the scaling, how long it might take, you know, a conventional computer to do, even though there is no such conventional computer that could do it.
Right.
It's kind of based on starting from small, building up step by step, and then extrapolating basically into the future.
Is this computer ready to go? I mean, can we use it? How big is it? And what will we be using it for?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So one of the things that we haven't discussed so far is precisely what calculation did they do in such a fast amount of time? And the calculation that they did is essentially a benchmark calculation. So it's not in any way a useful calculation. It's not something that you or I would ever be interested in calculating, nor would any company or anyone be interested in calculating. It was purely created and designed just to benchmark quantum computers.
Right.
So they can do it extremely fast, faster than any supercomputer, but there's no motivation for anyone to ever use this computer to do such a calculation except to check that the quantum computer did it correctly.
Right, okay.
So it can do this calculation, this very specific calculation, extremely fast, but you could ask, can it do other calculations equally fast? The answer, unfortunately, is no, not yet.
Oh.
So it can do this very specialist thing incredibly fast, but just that kind of problems at the moment.
Okay.
So it's a limited kind of computer. It has an incredible amount of power in this one use case, but that doesn't make it broadly applicable in the way that maybe your desktop can do many different tasks extremely fast.
Okay, so obviously this is a specific use case, and the technology will presumably be made more applicable for other applications. What sort of applications would we possibly need to solve, the problems we need to solve when it's this powerful?
Right, so I think that the use cases can be broadly put into three categories. One category is that there are certain tasks where it's been mathematically proven that a quantum computer can do this task much, much better than any conventional computer ever could. And so one famous example there is related to encryption. So it's factoring large numbers. So you might know that current, if you make a transaction on a bank account or some of that, that data is encrypted.
Yeah.
And a quantum computer could, in principle, break that encryption very easily. So that's one application where it's known the quantum computer is good.
Yeah.
The other two categories, one of them refers to things where we believe it will be very useful, although it's not maybe proven. So this would be things in like simulations of complex molecules.
Or climate modeling and that sort of thing.
Maybe more in the realm of quantum systems.
Right,
so climate modeling is more in the kind of, you know, atmospheric physics. But if we're more thinking about, say, complex molecules or something like that, where quantum mechanics is important, and so then using the quantum computer is useful.
Right. And then just really quickly, the final use case?
The final category is, let's say, the more speculative, you know, areas, so things like machine learning or AI, where there are some proposals where the quantum computer could be useful, maybe to speed up things, but where it's not maybe necessarily known. I mean, many companies maybe speculate on these kinds of uses, but at the moment, I would say the research is not really clear that this, in the long run, will be useful or not.
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting story, and it'll be really exciting to see what we can do with these computers as they become more broadly applicable. Dr. Kieran Hickey is from UCD Centre for Quantum Engineering, Science and Technology, Sequest. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
It was interesting that Kieran was saying that it can't do broadly applicable types of programming. I'd love to know why. Maybe if you know a lot about quantum computing, which you've tried to cover on this program a few times, and I feel like we get really close to a very clear explanation, but it does get pretty dense pretty quickly. If you know why the chip that they've developed at Google can only really do this one benchmarking calculation, which in any way is not useful at all, maybe you might explain why that is. But to get to some of your comments from last week, we are looking for your science teachers. So when you were young, did you have a science teacher who really inspired you to take science or do medicine, and did it change your life? We want to hear your stories of amazing science teachers. We got this email in, and someone says, I'm not sure if it's quite what you're looking for, but I'd love to give a shout out to Ape, the physics teacher who taught me for 2 years from 16. It was long ago, 1980s, and crazily, I've forgotten his actual name. He was always just Ape on account of the kind of beard that was very unfashionable in those clean-cut days. Rather than treating physics as a subject to be learned by rote, Ape led us through the syllabus through a spirit of inquiry and thinking through its underlying principles. To promote discussion, we sat in a circle rather than rows, and everyone was expected to contribute. Most of what little physics I can remember, I learned from Ape. He showed us how the theory could be applied in the real world, and as a result, I went on to a degree in physics and an astronomy. Alas, that was a mistake, because undergraduate physics was 3 years of fact-heavy instruction. As one chap put it, the purpose of a lecture is to get information from my slides to your notes without passing through the brain of either one of us. It was hard going, and I only survived it because I could do the maths. So the outcome from being such a great physics teacher was me choosing the wrong degree. How's that for an unexpected adverse consequences? Love the show, as I must have said before, and it's so much more engaging than the BBC alternatives, Andy Heard. Well, thank you very much for that, Andy. And I will take the compliment, although I do think they do some great work there at the old BBC. It's funny, isn't it? Sometimes you'd be so enthusiastic about something because you've just been inspired by someone, and then you run with it, and then you realize that not everybody is like that in that world. And it's a shame, actually, because, you know, there are some amazing physics professors in the world, and of course through history, you know, you think of Feynman and so many other really great thinkers who could communicate extraordinarily well at that third level area. I mean, we do think as teachers, certainly now when we look at what AI can do in terms of just giving information to students, we really do need to rethink how we engage our students when we're trying to teach them something complex. And whether or not standing in a room that's often overcrowded and poorly ventilated and poorly lit and speaking in a monotonous voice, pointing at slides and not really, you know, thinking about how we consume information as human beings, how we remember things, how emotion is a driver for almost everything that we remember. If we don't stimulate our children or our students as we get into secondary school and beyond into third level, it's, you know, it's kind of part of the gig. And I think it'll become even more part of the gig as we try and struggle with the introduction of AI. I think we're really going to have to start thinking about human to human learning and how we can augment it in the shadow of this thing that can just spit out answers without learning. And I think that's a real danger. That's it from us on this week's program. As we say, we do want your stories of amazing science teachers. So do email us, science@newstalk.com, and tell us the story of a science teacher who inspired you. And we might do something cool with that in January. So if you know someone who had a cool science teacher and ended up doing science, let them know to tell us the story. That's it from us on this show. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey. Aaron Jordan was helping out in the box, and Hugo de Silva was on sound. We'll be back with more on Tuesday with your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.